So if you look back to Wordsworth, how Wordsworth, even though he was writing from a distance, as Mary Favre argues that, you know, he represents war from a distance, yet if you think about how subtly he captures the psychology that the first-hand accounts do, is still quite telling. Another poem by Wordsworth, The Female Vagrant, which was composed in 1793 and then revised in 1798, presents the story of war's effects on a woman. The Female Vagrant, it's a long poem included in the collection Lyrical Ballads, which Wordsworth and Coleridge published together. It depicts a woman traumatized by war. The speaker is the female vagrant herself. Her husband had no choice but to enlist for the American War of Independence due to his family's poverty and the difficulties of finding work. Even though the poem is set during an earlier war, not the Napoleonic Wars, Wordsworth writes this during the outbreak of the French Revolutionary Wars, foreshadowing the devastation and warning about the real cost of war in terms of individual human suffering. By the time he published this in the Lyrical Ballads in 1798, his warnings about the cruelties of war had become a fulfilled prophecy. It is typical of the poems of the Lyrical Ballads to express strong political opinions in a covert, disguised or distanced form, hidden behind the ordinary language allegedly spoken by the poor. We mustn't forget that this is the time when the free expression of political opinion in Britain was dangerous following the gagging acts in 1795 and the repeated suspension of the habeas corpus throughout the 1790s. So it was a kind of time of internal terror. William Pitt was Prime Minister, Conservative Prime Minister. There was a lot of fear at the time, fear about spies, about invasion, and about the revolution and the violence coming home. And that also manifested in a lot of measures that they took to curb civil rights. So the poets had to be very careful how to write about political, how to express political opinions. So just to, you know, just to say that romantics weren't always just about nature. There is a lot more going on. They were trying to speak up at a particularly difficult time, and we should bear that in mind when we read them. So anyway, it is hard to miss the parallels with the present war. I mean, the Wordsworth is the war that was going on at the time of writing. In the story, a female vagrant loses her entire family in the war. She accompanies her husband to America, but there all her loved ones die. He writes, "The pains and plagues that on our heads came down, disease and famine, agony and fear, in wood or wilderness, in camp or town, it would thy brain unsettle even to hear, all perished, all in one remorseless year, husband and children, one by one, by sword and ravenous plague, all perished. Every tear, dried up, despairing, desolate, on board a British ship I waked, as from a trance, restored." And once she's on board of this the ship, she's haunted by nightmares and memories about what she's been through. Arguably, her experience is similar to what we now call combat post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, you can't retrospectively diagnose, but there's an interesting similarity in the symptoms she's manifesting, we'll see in a minute. Similarly, characterized by recurring nightmares and flashbacks induced by a traumatic experience. She's haunted by horrific images, heaps of decomposing corpses and collapsing mines where soldiers are buried alive. Ah, how unlike those late terrific sleeps and groans that rage of racking famine spoke, where looks inhuman dwelt on festering heaps, the breathing pestilence that rose like smoke, the shriek that from the distant battle broke, the mine's dire earthquake and the pallid host driven by the bomb's incessant thunderstroke, to loathsome bolts where heartsick anguish tossed, hope died and fear itself in agony was lost. Yet does that burst of woe congeal my frame when the dark streets appeared to heave and gape, while like a sea the stormy army came, and fire from hell reaped his gigantic shape, and murder by the ghastly gleam and rape seized their joint prey, the mother and the child. But from these crazing thoughts my brain escape. For weeks the balmy air breathed soft and mild, and on the gliding vessel heaven and ocean smiled. And then when she goes back home, she's going to be a poor beggar, unable to work, and sitting by the road. Now, I would like to move on to another poet, Lord Byron, and continue with the topic of emotion. Byron's Childe Harold's Pilgrimage is, for those of you who are not familiar with it, a lengthy narrative poem in four cantos. Cantos 1 and 2 were published in 1812, and they brought a huge overnight success to Byron. Byron writes, "I woke up one morning and found myself famous." It contributed to Byron becoming a very modern kind of celebrity. Its protagonist, Childe Harold, is a disillusioned, world-weary young man, an alter ego for Byron himself, who leaves his home country and embarks on foreign travels. Today I'll be mainly focusing on Canto 3, which was published in 1816, and this canto features Byron's and Childe Harold's visit to Waterloo. As you know, the Battle of Waterloo took place in 1815, exactly 200 years ago. Now, this image is by Turner, the Field of Waterloo. It's one of the many, many representations of the battle. But the interesting thing is that while many, many contemporaries like to represent the victory and Wellington and the success, this one shows the darker side of this victory. Shows the wounded, the dead, and the people looking for loved ones on the scene of battle. So it's definitely not one of the heroic representations of Waterloo. In Canto 3 of Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, Harold, Byron's restless, unsociable hero, visits the field of Waterloo. It is now 1816, so a year after the battle. Only a year before, this was a site of carnage. Over 40,000 were killed in the battle that brought victory for Britain and Europe in 1815. Now the empty, desolate field is invested with feelings through which shards of history unfold in the form of individual and collective memory. So whilst Byron's character is walking on the battlefield, he's remembering things, and often we're not quite sure whether this is now Byron or Childe Harold talking. The two here get very close to each other. Now, feelings that bind the individual's private feelings to public experience are a central preoccupation of this poem. But things are very different in Canto 1. So, in Canto 1, Childe Harold even asks, "But why should I for others groan when none will sigh for me?" So, this Childe Harold, at the very beginning, in Canto 1, is someone whose pride has just been wounded by unrequited love. And so he sees the entirety of his homeland as unfeeling, indifferent, and dull. In turn, his response is a withdrawal of all affective investment in his surroundings, Thus, Canto 1 commences with Harold's unfeeling farewell to his homeland. He denies all concern, seemingly lacking the ability to grieve his departure. Unlike others who go with him, he is saying that for pleasures past I do not grieve, nor perils gathering near. My greatest grief is that I leave no thing that claims a tear. So he's very fed up, he's not feeling anything, claims not to feel anything, and he leaves for his travels. Thus, in the first canto, Harold sets out on his journey cynical, in denial of his feelings. But so this is really the Byronic hero as we know it. In Canto 3, on the other hand, emotion returns to our protagonist only to become the central concern of the poem. At the heart of Canto 3 is Harold's visit to the field of Waterloo. Contemporary art and poetry often represents the battle from the angle of Wellington's victory. Tribute is paid to the dead, but more importantly, the defeat of Napoleon and Wellington's heroism are celebrated. For instance, in Thomas Fitzgerald's The Battle of Waterloo, Napoleon's defeat is celebrated there. The muse's prophecy is complete at last. Thy reign, detested Corsican, is past, and heaven decreed in its appointed hour that Britain's arm should crush the tyrant's power. But where's the bard, however graced his name, can venture to describe great Wellesley's fame? Although he also talks about the dead later on, and in a way that is quite similar to the way in which Byron talks about the dead in his famous line, where he writes how rider and horse, friend, foe, in one red burial blend. Thomas Fitzgerald writes, horses and horsemen strew the plain, and cannon mingle with the slain, one fate attends them all. So the enemy forces are, you know, you all get the same fate, the horses, the wheat field, the dead are all buried together. But despite Wellington's victory, Waterloo unfortunately brought loss and mourning for most British families. So that is what is the crux, I think, of Byron's discontent here, is that, okay, it was a victory, but actually most people at the time lost someone. So the nation was mourning, despite the fact that, it was officially a victory. In another poem, there's another Wordsworth poem that, after visiting the field of Waterloo, Wordsworth mentions the horror and the carnage that accompanied the battle. But he also has a poem about the glory and the victory, the victorious aspect. So Byron incorporates all these previous poems and these ideas and themes. Yet I think I'd like to read this canto as first and foremost a poem of mourning. And I think it is very different from the other poems that preceded this or surrounded this. Not only does it capture the darker side of Waterloo, but it is filled with the political discontent that the poetry of Wordsworth and Southey, so the poetry of the first generation of the Romantic poets, could no longer convey. The collective victory masked numerous instances of personal loss, tragedy, and trauma, but also the conservative reorganization throughout Europe after 1815 was seen by Byron as a disappointing turn. So it goes hand in hand. So his disappointment is, okay, it's not just about the loss, but also about what came after Waterloo, which was a restoration of the old system of monarchies throughout Europe, something similar to what it was before the French Revolution's achievement. And that's what Byron is quite disillusioned and upset about. As he expresses his disillusionment, in vain years of death, depopulation, bondage, fears have all been born. So all this killing, all this was for nothing after all. The ideals and achievements of the revolution are lost when we who struck the lion down pay the wolf homage. The ambivalence of the historical moment is likely the reason for the restless oscillation of conflicting images and feelings in the poem. War in the poem is superimposed in peace in the imagery. Death and life come together, motion and stillness, pain and joy, the other and the self, the nation and the individual become inseparable. It becomes impossible to talk about one without mentioning or implying the other. And this double-sidedness is the central organizing theme of the canto, which is reflected in its tropes throughout. So it's full of oxymorons, paradoxes, contrasts. They take the center stage in the kind of literary construction of this poem to express all these conflicting, all these ambivalent forces throughout. Visiting the field of Waterloo for Byron is both a private and a public act. Byron's visit in 1816 was an act of remembrance and personal mourning. So on the one hand, that's the time when Byron leaves England and never to return, really. So his family life fell apart. He was basically a big scandal at the time. He's very disappointed, and he's disappointed in the whole political system that I just mentioned. So he's going to Geneva, and he's passing through, and he's going to Waterloo on the way, and he stops there in 1816 and reflects. Overwhelmed with sentiment, Byron's voice cuts into the story of Harold in order to mourn his own cousin who died there. His cousin was called Frederick Howard, who fell in the battle. Byron draws a contrast between the death of his relation and the living tree which still flourishes where Howard fell. The tree is fresh and green, and the field is revived with fruits and fertile promise. So the cycle of nature continues and life goes on regardless of all the death. The hollow that marks the spot where Howard fell is already half filled and on its way towards complete erasure, Byron notes in the notes section, actually. Now, the hollow is now half filled with whatever is growing there in the field now, and it's going to be erased. Living on, in spite of our losses, is the canto's central preoccupation, and all the main tropes structuring the poem are in some way expressive of survival in the face of grief. He writes, "I turned to thee, to thousands, of whom each and one has all a ghastly gap did make in his own kind and kindred, whom to teach forgetfulness were mercy for their sake. The archangel's trump, not glories, must awake those whom they thirst for. Though the sound of fame may for a moment soothe, it cannot slake the fever of vain longing, and the name so honoured but assumes a stronger, bitterer claim. They mourn but smile at length." So he's talking about the survivors here, those who have to live on with all this, with the remembrance of those whom they lost, the families. "They mourn but smile at length, and smiling mourn. The tree will wither long before it fall. The hull drives on, though mast and sail are torn. The roof tree sinks, but moulder on the hull in massy hoariness. The ruined wall stands when its wind-worn battlements are gone. The bards survive the captive they enthrall. The day drags through, though storms keep out the sun, and thus the heart will break, yet brokenly live on." Here, fame and glory cannot outshine the damage done by the loss of human life. Surviving is like living on with a broken heart. It is a matter of existing in a permanent state of oxymorons, of living death, of smiling whilst mourning. These are tropes of a dysfunctional, pointless existence for both personal and political reasons. As Byron implies, throughout the poem we now have to live in a state of perpetual mourning and in a post-Waterloo monarchical conservative Europe, similar to what we had before the revolution's achievement. But mourning the one soon becomes a reflection on mourning the thousands who fell in the battle. When remembering his cousin, Byron also pays tribute to everyone who died there, rider and horse, friend, foe, and describes the state of mourning as a fever of vain longing, where the heart will break, yet brokenly live on. Living on in a state of hopeless, vain longing for those who can never return is expressed beautifully in the extended simile of this stanza. The withering tree, the hull without its mast and sail, the wall without its battlement, and the bars without their captive, all keep existing without their true meaning and function. They're all thus similar to living life with a broken heart, when life's very purpose has been lost. Images of war-ridden objects are beautifully juxtaposed with the feelings of individual loss and disappointment, making private feeling inseparable from the collective historical event. And the beautiful imagery continues in the next stanza. Even as a broken mirror which the glass in every fragment multiplies and makes a thousand images of one that was the same, and still the more it breaks, and thus the heart will do which not forsakes, living in a shattered guise and still and cold and bloodless, with its sleepless sorrow aches, yet withers on till all without is old, showing no visible signs, for such things are untold. Indeed, many aspects of the experience of war show no visible sign, and like the trauma and melancholia of survival and loss, remain untold behind the facade of collective victory and defeat. The metaphor of the broken mirror is expressive here of the way in which one's grief is multiplied by and reflected in the grief of thousands. The painful experience of one replicates the experience of everyone else, as if multiplying and intensifying the grief suffered by individuals and nations alike, in the same way as every piece of glass mirrors other shards, and thus multiplies the reflection of the broken fragments. Byron uses this as a metaphor for the heart which not forsakes, that is, the heart that cannot let go and cannot mourn. The broken mirror is Byron's trope of mourning the other's loss in one's own loss, tying a close bond between the feelings of private individuals and across nations. Thus, the broken mirror metaphor figures a special kind of grieving that the Waterloo experience brings about, a silent, invisible grief that is hard to let go of, and impossible to express. Now, Sigmund Freud would define this state as melancholia, as the impossibility to let go and to mourn, the impossibility to mourn. Freud wrote his essay Mourning and Melancholia in 1915, so exactly 100 years after this, during the First World War, which is an interesting coincidence in this context. And he says that the difference between mourning and melancholia is that in mourning you gradually let go of the lost object and you can move on, while in melancholia you take the lost object inside you and can never let go and become ill because of that, and the strife continues inside yourself. So it's something similar here, this inability to let go and to kind of move on, but never really let go of the pain. After Waterloo, the grief is special in that it lives on under the surface of victory's joy as a form of hidden private feeling, which causes symptoms nevertheless. Just like the way in which nature erases the hollow where Howard fell, the experience of human loss similarly shows no apparent sign. Behind the surface, however, it with its sleepless sorrow aches, uniting the heartbroken individual, the broken nation, and the Europe, which lost many lives and great political ideas. It is in this way that the survivors mourn, but smile at length, and smiling mourn. The joy of survival, victory, and fame can never be void of the pain of loss. Finally, I would like to return to Mary Favre's argument in War at a Distance. It is true that Byron's poem cannot claim the immediacy of a first-hand account of war, but I wouldn't say that it keeps the reality of war outside of the public awareness. What I would argue instead is that Byron memorializes through feeling, through reawakening his own and the reader's emotions. His wandering is a way of reliving the past. By being physically present at a particular place, Byron recalls the story of that place, but also the emotions connected to that story. Even though Harold and Byron are cynical and detached, they're like that when they're home. But once they leave home and go to the scene of the battle, their strong feelings which they otherwise seem to lack are aroused. They seem to be capable of feeling only when they're living in the past, in those particular fragments, as if they had left their emotions in those broken pieces of human history. Wandering might be an attempt to put the pieces together, self and history, the self within history. So the Byronic hero has thus transformed here from a disaffected character to a man of feeling, and in turn he brings to life war as an emotional experience. So finally, just to recap where we've been today, the Napoleonic and the Revolutionary Napoleonic Wars were, we said, the first modern war or total war. They broke out in response to the violent phase of the French Revolution and to Napoleon's imperial ambitions, and they often depicted as heroic in mainstream art and propaganda, but we have seen how romantic literature, and by literature I also mean any written documents, personal accounts and memoirs too, how they uncover the war's true devastation that sometimes other accounts fail to acknowledge. Thank you.